So Mr. Goldberg has to testify. And the judge says to him, "What's your name?" He says, "Irving Goldberg." He says, "And how old are you, Mr. Goldberg?" He says, 83, Kenan Hara. The judge says, no, Mr. Goldberg, just give me your age. He says, 83, Kenan Hara. The judge says, "Mr. Goldberg, perhaps you don't understand. I don't want you to say anything else. Just for the record, tell me your age." He says, 83, Kenan Hara. The judge says, "Mr. Goldberg, I'm going to hold you in contempt, and I don't want to do that." And the lawyer now intervenes. He says, "Your Honor, if you don't mind, may I ask Mr. Goldberg?" He says, "Go ahead." He says, "Mr. Goldberg, how old are you, Kenan Hara?" He says, 83. Now, that's a very Jewish joke. Because we really do believe in the power of words. Like the Jew who comes back from Israel and someone says to him, "So tell me in a word, how is Israel doing these days?" He says, "Good." He says, "Okay, give me two words." He goes, "Not good." And since the first day of Rosh Hashanah, as those of you know who have been here for many years, is always, for me, it's supposed to be the state of the Jewish world, I'm going to get to the way the Jewish world is talking these days. But I'm going to take a different route. I want to tell you the story of two mountains. You've heard of both of them. But you might not know in Jewish history what they represent. And I want to start with the mountain that gave this synagogue its name, Sinai. Mount Sinai represents the Jews in the wilderness, the leader, Moses, the giving of the law. But it also represents something else very powerful in our tradition. Because remember, Sinai is before the Israelites get into the land. And therefore, when you read what Moshe has to say about what the Jews need to do to earn the land, you will be struck that what Sinai represents is the self-criticism of the Jewish people. Moshe says, when you go into that land, you have to act this way, and you have to act that way. And if you don't act up to the moral standards of the Jewish people, God will punish you. And Moshe was not alone in this. The later prophets, taking the Sinai tradition, said the same thing. They said to the people, you have to behave a certain way when you have the land. There is a responsibility to your own moral standards that comes with having stood at Sinai, and that's what Sinai represents. Now, this is an uncomfortable tradition. Believe me, it was uncomfortable thousands of years ago. When Jeremiah yelled at the people, telling them that they were being immoral and that they didn't deserve the land that they were on, they literally put him in chains and threw him in prison. The prophet Jeremiah. Nobody likes to hear themselves criticized. And as the old Yiddish saying has it, Jews are like everybody else, only more so. But we have to realize that when we speak in criticism of ourselves, that is an ancient tradition and a noble tradition and a necessary tradition. And those who say that Jews should never criticize Jews need to read their Bible. Because Moses didn't believe it, and neither did Jeremiah, and neither did Ezekiel, and neither did Isaiah, and neither did Joel, and neither did Amos, and neither did the rabbis, and neither should you. But it's not the only mountain in the Jewish tradition. There is another mountain that represents something else in Judaism that is equally important. And that's Mount Zion. While Sinai represents the wilderness, the law, Moshe, wandering, self-criticism, Zion represents the land, the government, the state, and King David. And David and Moshe are very different figures. And Zion and Sinai represent very different traditions. Because you see, once the Jews came to Zion, then they were in the land. And then they actually had to deal with what it means to govern the land. And then they had to make, as David did, and all the kings after him, compromises with the purity of ideals because, after all, you have to keep your people safe in the land. This fight between the purity of ideals and the reality of what it means to have power and to keep power and to use it to protect yourselves, this runs through Jewish history and has never been more poignant than it is today. You saw it almost as if crystallized in perfect form with the question of whether Israel should take in refugees. Herzog spoke for the Sinai tradition. Ki gerim hayitem be'eretz Mitzrayim. You were strangers in the land of Egypt. Here are strangers. How can we not take them in? Netanyahu spoke for the Zion tradition. For you must be safe in your own land. How can we be safe in our land if we take in people that might wish to destroy us? But even though you read the debate, you might not have known that this goes back to the roots of our tradition. And neither voice is un-Jewish. Neither voice is un-Jewish. When a Jew says, I mourn the loss of people that Israel kills in war, of Palestinians, of Palestinian children, that's very Jewish. You know what Lincoln said when someone, one of his generals, he was talking about the Confederate dead, and one of his generals said, what are they to us? And Lincoln, who by the way loved Jews, said, I am glad the world is larger than your heart. It is very Jewish to wish not the destruction of your enemies, but the enlightenment of your enemies. If you listen to that poem that I deliberately read, because I was seeding my sermon, from Israel Zangwill, the medieval poem, you see what he says. He doesn't wish for idolaters to be destroyed. He wishes for them to be enlightened and to go hand in hand to Mount Zion one day. And when you hear, and I often do, when you criticize something that Jews do or that Israel does, that they're worse, that how can you compare us? It doesn't matter what we do, because after all, look at what our enemies do. I'm always reminded of what the writer Chekhov said. He said, you cannot become a saint with other people's sins. That other people are bad doesn't make you good. Goodness makes you good. And the bad things that we need to do to keep our land safe, and we do, should make us sad. I bring this up because the way Jews talk about Jews sometimes in our day is disgraceful. They talk about the other side, whichever the other side is, as though he is un-Jewish. But the truth is that both voices are very Jewish. What is Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur? It is 10 days of self-criticism. And we put it in the plural. We have sinned. And yet then if somebody says, we have sinned outside the synagogue, everybody says, how can you say that? We should never criticize ourselves. What a terrible religious role model we would be for the world if we were never willing to criticize ourselves. It is one of the glories of our people. And if you don't believe that Jews will criticize themselves, all I can say is you've never visited Israel, where there is more serious, probing, deep, beautiful self-criticism than you could imagine if you haven't read it and seen it. Yes, we have terrible enemies. And yes, the enemies of the Jewish people become the enemies of the world. It is an iron law of history. But no, that doesn't mean that we all have to speak with one voice. It doesn't mean that we can't disagree with one another. It doesn't mean that we can't respect people, even if we're convinced that they're wrong, because I will tell you a secret about arguing that I learned a long time ago that I wish not only our people would learn, but even some people in public life. Which is calling someone a traitor or an idiot or stupid never won an argument and never made a friend. Sometimes I think that our arguments are all for invective, and instead of making peace, we just want to score points. But I will remind you of something that I have said again and again, but unfortunately, I am not tired of saying it because it still needs to be said. I don't care how much you disagree with other parts of the Jewish community, you will need them tomorrow, and next week, and next month, and next year. And everybody that you alienate forever is someone you alienate forever. And it's very hard to make common cause with someone who called you a traitor yesterday. There is no reason why deep, passionate conviction cannot be sustained by deep, passionate argument that doesn't belittle, doesn't degrade, doesn't insult the other party. I think this in politics in general, but especially among Jews. Do you realize how small we are, how few there are, how much we need each other? How unexpectedly you may need that person tomorrow whom you dismiss today. I have in my life been surprised again and again and again by what people bring to you whom you had in your mind dismissed. He's not Jewish, but I will give you what for me was perhaps the most powerful example I had this year. I was in a conference in Belgrade, and I was sitting at a table with a man named Vuk Jeremić. I don't know if that name means anything to you. It meant nothing to me, but he was once the president of the United Nations. It's a one-year rotating position. Not the secretary general, but the president. He told me his father was a Serbian Christian and his mother, a Bosnian Muslim. And I thought, great. From both sides, and he was the president of the UN. We had lunch together. They were discussing other things. Israel, Jews didn't come up. I was glad. And then at the end of the lunch, he said, can you stay here for a second? I said, sure. Everybody left. He's standing right in front of me. And he starts to get tears in his eyes. And he said, I just wanted to tell you that my great-grandfather and my grandparents, who were Bosnian Muslims, hid Jews throughout the war. That they asked my grandfather to be the head of the Croatian fascists, and he turned them down at risk of his life because he knew what they were doing to the Jews. And then he hugs me, and I hug him, and we both have tears in our eyes, and I think, what did you think of this man 20 minutes ago? You stupid rabbi. But we dismiss people on the basis of assumptions or views, even people in our own community. If they disagree with us about this political deal or that possibility, we sum them up as though their character is worthless. It's wrong and it's ugly and it is un-Jewish. Rabbi Akiva said the greatest mitzvah in the Torah is v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. You should love your neighbor as yourself. I've come to a new understanding of this. I've told the story before of the rabbi who, when I was in rabbinical school, told me what the secret of the rabbinate was. He said to me, don't become a rabbi unless you love Jews. You have to love Jews, or it'll be a terrible life. But now I think I see one level deeper. Don't become a rabbi unless you think you can help Jews to love each other. That's the job. In a nutshell. And one of the ways you do it is by breaking people's assumptions that if you don't agree with their views, you aren't worth listening to. That you're wrong or bad. That you don't love what they love or cherish what they cherish. And I have met too many, too different, to believe that God wants us to all see the world with a single set of eyes. The reason now I think it says, V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, you should love your neighbor as yourself, is not because it's easier than loving someone on the other side of the world, but because it's harder. The closer someone is to you, the harder it is to realize that they're different and still you must love them. It is a positive mitzvah, Ahavat Yisrael. You have to love Jews when they infuriate you, when they disappoint you, when you think that they're wrong, that what they're saying is dangerous, that you have to counteract them, do, but you can still love them. What is going on inside the Jewish community, both here and in Israel, is as dangerous for Jews as anything. Because the only way that we can face the threats of this world is if we don't break apart. I know how hard it is. I know that the pleasures of indignation are great, that it is wonderful to be angry and to say angry things and cruel things and then stand up and say, I only said that because it needed to be said. But it's not what needs to be said. Here's what needs to be said. You're wrong, but I still love you. I think that the course you're pursuing is dangerous, but I love you. I hope you can't get other Jews to agree with you, but as a Jew, you're part of my family, so I love you. It's not easy. But love has been defined many ways. It's never been defined as an easy thing to do. Remember that at his most critical point, when Moshe came down the mountain and he saw that all of Israel, at the moment he was carrying the tablets from God, at the greatest moment in the history of our people, and he saw that all of Israel was dancing around the golden calf. God said to Moses, I'm going to destroy this people and make you a great people, because you're the only one with any sense here. And you remember what Moses said. Before you destroy them, you're going to have to destroy me. Because Moses' love of Israel was greater than his obedience to God. Now, if Moses could feel that way when the Jews were dancing around the golden calf, can we not sometimes feel that way when other Jews disagree with us? Can we not forbear calling them names, denigrating their characters, dismissing their communities? V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, ze klal gadol b'Torah. That's what Rabbi Akiva said. Love your neighbor as yourself. That is the great principle of the Torah. So don't tell me, when people say things that violate it, that they're being Jewish. They're not. I want to create an army of tolerance inside our own community. L'takein olam b'malchut Shaddai. Make the world better the way God intends, which is a world of closeness, not a world of agreement. Not a world of assent, not a world without arguments. God knows our ancestors argued all the time. But they understood that we live in a hostile and sometimes cruel world. And there is only one way to face cruelty. And that is with the strength that comes from love. May this coming year be a year of goodness, a year of strength, a year of peace. And for the people of Israel, a year of love.